Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Each year we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. Day with clips from the Reverend Doctor's powerful speeches. We see footage of protesters in Birmingham sprayed by fire hoses and set upon by dogs, or white residents taunting students walking to school in Little Rock. What we don't see is Dr. King leading tens of thousands on a freedom march through Boston in 1965 to protest segregation in the city's housing and schools. We rarely revisit the race riots in Detroit or tanks rolling in Newark or that piercing photo of a Boston mob attacking a prominent black attorney with an American flag on a pole. For many Northeast residents, ideas of slavery and segregation are distinctly Southern. The North is progressive, after all, the seat of the abolitionist movement, the Harlem Renaissance, the place where Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier and where jobs, homes, and opportunity were on offer for those fleeing the Jim Crow South. UNH history professor Jason Sokol identifies some big gaps between the North's political liberalism and abject bigotry. He's here to talk about the conflicted soul of the Northeast, as covered in his book, All Eyes Are Upon Us. And Jason Sokol, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you focus on Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New York as the seats of the Northern mystique. What is the Northern mystique?
The Northern mystique is a belief, as you alluded to, the fact that the North has been this center of political liberalism, cultural enlightenment, and racial progressivism. And, you know, I think this is, to some extent, this has been a myth that the North is better than the South. But I think at times, Northerners' beliefs that they are capable of certain breakthroughs have sort of propelled them forward in a way when, for instance, the South has sometimes been held back. But I focus on Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New York because I think they're most often associated by many people as being the heart of this progressivism and liberalism.
I'd love to dig into that sort of self-regard as being colorblind and how that notion of being free from bigotry influenced the fight for racial equality in the North.
The idea that they were colorblind, many white Northerners adhered to this, believed that they didn't really see color and contrasted themselves with white Southerners who they thought were clearly bigots and segregationists. Now, that belief in colorblindness actually cut both ways during the Civil Rights era. On the one hand, when you look at politics, for instance, white Northerners could actually vote for African-American candidates. For instance, Ed Brooke was the first black senator elected since Reconstruction. He was elected by Massachusetts voters in 1966. Part of all the rhetoric of that campaign was that voters in Massachusetts were colorblind, and Brooke played into that to get in part to get elected. On the other hand, Massachusetts voters thought that they were colorblind, and when you apply that to things like schools and housing, you know, school officials, school committee officials said, well, we're colorblind. We just assign students to whatever neighborhood they're in. Well, that produced racial segregation, and it fed and accelerated and worsened that segregation. So in that realm of life, schools and housing, this supposed colorblindness merely increased segregation and deepened racial inequality.
Well, as you point out, the idea of being colorblind or progressive helped at least create a sense of what could happen. As one writer put it, it created a greater responsibility to racial progress. So what did that mean for African Americans living in the Northeast? You know, these big leaps in ideas of racial progress followed by on-the-ground backlashes, which I think you illustrate very well in the story of Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson's Brooklyn. Tell us that story.
Well, at certain moments, this widespread belief in colorblindness could create an opening in which African Americans could actually break through that opening and achieve certain types of progress that weren't possible elsewhere. And 1947 was the year when Jackie Robinson joined the Brooklyn Dodgers. You know, when I started researching this story, I had to remind myself, 1947, that's almost a decade before anyone had heard of Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks. He was a real pioneer. And Brooklyn was, you know, hailed by many as a real melting pot. And whites in Brooklyn themselves, you know, patted themselves on the back for their ability to embrace and root for Jackie Robinson. Well, you know, that kind of progress only went so far. Jackie Robinson experienced firsthand the vicious housing discrimination when he tried to buy a home not only in New York City, but then when he tried to move to the white suburbs. It took them several years to find any town that would allow, that would sell, any white owner that would sell to a black family, even if that family was Jackie Robinson, the most, you know, the most valuable player in the National League.
Now, not everyone was smugly caught up in this idea or patting themselves on the back about being progressives. The junior senator from Connecticut stood on the Senate floor in 1970 and charged that the North is guilty. Guilty of what, was he saying?
This was Abraham Ribicoff, who was the senator from Connecticut. And 1970, he stood on the floor and he said the North is guilty of racial hypocrisy. And he said, you know, we have as much racism and segregation here in the North as there is anywhere else. White Southerners said, here's one liberal Northerner who finally gets it, who finally understands that the North is just as bad as the South. Here was this liberal Jew from Connecticut who was now a Confederate hero because he finally told the truth. The story got more complicated when one year later, Ribicoff actually proposed a bill that would do what he actually wanted to do. And Ribicoff proposed this bill that was designed to help every urban and suburban school system integrate their schools over the course of a decade. Now, when Ribicoff finally proposed that bill, white Southerners said, hang on a minute. I don't think he's really our hero. We don't really want to go along with this bill.
What you point out is the fall of the North. In 1971, the Supreme Court ruled that busing could be used to achieve racial integration, and Boston became the epicenter of resistance to busing. Now, this was after a lawsuit by the NAACP kind of forced the hand of the judiciary. A few really decisive moments in that fight, including one on September 12th, this is 1974, when an angry mob marched from the Common to Government Center. What happened?
Yeah, this was an anti-busing mob. So it was a mob of thousands of whites in Boston. And Federal Judge Garrity in June had ruled that Boston schools would have to be integrated. And he ruled that students would be bused between different neighborhoods. Now, he paired South Boston with Roxbury, which was an explosive combination,
right,
to say the least. And thousands of whites in Boston were very angry, and they marched to Government Center, and they had a rowdy protest. Ted Kennedy made a surprise appearance at his office there. And he got, you know, basically run down by the mob, which ran up to the windows and stormed the building and broke the glass. There was a lot of anger and hatred and violence in those streets.
So blood was flowing now in the cradle of liberty, right? Now, how was this viewed by the rest of the country?
The rest of the country, to some extent, people were surprised that this was happening in Boston. You know, some people around the country still had this view of Boston and New England as somehow more progressive than other places. White Southerners were euphoric. They wrote many letters to the Boston Globe saying, "See, you guys have had these race difficulties for years. Now it's just chickens coming home to roost, basically." And, you know, the reaction of African-Americans around the country was to view Boston as a place they never wanted to go to.
"People of color are not safe to come here to Boston, and we're asking people across the country of color to stay away."
And Boston has had that reputation ever since the busing crisis, even before. I mean, Bill Russell, he wrote very passionately about the racism that he faced in Boston in the 1950s and 60s. And then when this happened in the 70s, you know, African-Americans said, I'm not going there. It was viewed as just as unsafe for them as Mississippi.
I have to say, 10 years ago, I did a fellowship, you know, across the river in Cambridge. But two African-Americans and a Latino man, they were terrified of coming to Boston. And I feel like, you know, I thought, oh, that was so long ago. But there is this kind of, how are we implicated, you know, as Northerners, as people who are Northeastern New England folks, in this idea that, oh, that was just a thing of the past. This is over now.
I mean, to the extent that white Northerners still believe that, then I would say, yeah, we're all wrong and we're certainly all implicated until we demand policies that are more aggressive in terms of making our cities and towns more welcoming and more open and more equal places for racial minorities and impoverished racial minorities to live.
Well, you point out, you know, busing is one of those policies that the right and the left could agree, oh, this was just a mess. You know, it was bad. But considering the results and the data, did busing actually successfully integrate Boston schools?
Busing brought a measure of desegregation to Boston schools that would have never come about had busing not been implemented. So, you know, busing brought violence. Busing accelerated white flight from the city, which had already been happening well for decades before busing, but it did accelerate that. But it also integrated some schools that had not been integrated and that would not have been integrated otherwise.
In the introduction, you refer to a speech Dr. King wrote about America being schizophrenic about race, back to the Declaration of Independence. And in your book, it's a place of opportunity on the one hand. You know, Edward Brooke gets elected in Massachusetts, Shirley Chisholm in Brooklyn in the 1960s. Decades later, Deval Patrick paving the way for Obama's election. And yet, hours after Barack Obama is elected, first black president of the United States, the Macedonia Church of God in Springfield, Massachusetts, a black church, was torched.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the disconnect here?
Yeah, I think America has always had a commitment to these two conflicting ideals, call them freedom on the one hand and segregation on the other, or, you know, democracy on the one hand and exclusion on the other. You know, this kind of contradictory legacy still plays out today. And so, you know, one explanation is that there was a backlash against Obama's election and that it was felt in Springfield, Mass, just as it was felt in Deep South states that didn't vote for Obama, where white voters and white Americans saw this great leap forward in America's political history. And they lashed out against it. They realized that the world wasn't theirs to do with as they pleased any longer. And what I mean by that is that, you know, for so long, white Americans had been the vast majority and still hold the vast majority of wealth and power. Well, whites got scared, I think, by Obama's election. And you can still see a lot of that resistance nowadays, and whether it's violence in the streets or whether it's just rhetoric against the president.
How about now, Jason? I mean, I think of Ferguson and Baltimore and Waller County, Texas, you know, places that feel very far away from the circumstances and the temperament of life in the great Northeast. I mean, do these recent cases of police brutality kind of perpetuate the Northern mystique? It doesn't happen here.
Well, Eric Garner, you know, that case happened in Staten Island. And so I would say that it does happen here. And if people think that it doesn't happen here, well, they're just telling themselves a happier tale than is actually the truth. Because, I mean, these incidents do happen in New England. They do happen in the Northeast. You know, so the fact that the street protests haven't gotten to the level in New England as they have in, say, Ferguson or Cleveland, well, I think they could if you just had an episode with more publicity.
Jason Sokol, enlightening for me anyway. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Jason Sokol, he's assistant professor of history at UNH and author of All Eyes Are Upon Us. You'll find much more on the book and more on Jason at wordofmouthradio.org.